This is a BloomerBoomer.com podcast with our movie reviewer and historian, Greg Potasik, who spent a lifetime reporting on the movie industry. Whether writing for The Hollywood Reporter or co-founding the celebrated music magazine Rock, BloomerBoomer.com Greg takes the films popular when baby boomers came of age and masterfully intertwines them with today's newest releases. Greg's co-host is Andy Asher.
Hi, everyone. Greg's movie review this week is a very fascinating topic, and he's calling it black and white. Now, it has to do with a very wrenching and difficult subject in our culture and our society, and black and white relations. But he's first going to talk about something that has just come up that he just can't hold back on, and then we'll get into the review. Well, Greg, what's the big news in the movie industry right now?
Well, right now, Hollywood's abuzz about the two films selected as Best Pictures of the Year. It was a tie by the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. Now, this is a group of film critics who obviously are in Los Angeles. Sometimes they work for papers and media beyond Los Angeles, but all these critics are based here in Los Angeles. They have a reputation of picking films that aren't necessarily in the mainstream or don't necessarily reflect the biggest box office films. And once that they tend to be a little more edgy than the films that you'll see for Best Picture Oscar nominations. But the two films in question were Gravity, and that's a film that we talked about last time with Sandra Bullock, and then a film that is just beginning to open and is probably isn't scheduled to open in most of the country until the end of the year. It's a film called Her, H-E-R, starring Joaquin Phoenix with an interesting co-star, Scarlett Johansson, as his essentially his co-star, but we never see her because she plays, doing strictly voiceover, of course, an operating system, if you will, a computer operating system, who is Joaquin Phoenix's personal computer assistant. And this is sometime in the near future. And sort of like Gravity, sometime in the near future, like just on the horizon, so we can understand the technology. It seems very realistic. And Scarlett Johansson plays a character where she isn't real. She's a computer program. So shades of HAL from 2001 Space Odyssey, except this time around it's a woman, and the computer character isn't at all dangerous or ominous. In fact, it becomes his best friend. And so it's an interesting premise.
Gosh, and the two actors, I can't believe. Joaquin Phoenix, of all people, who changed careers and direction and other things and was going to become a musician.
Retired at one point.
Yeah. And then the most beautiful Scarlett Johansson.
Yes, and her very, very sexy voice. She has a very sexy voice, and the director, it definitely plays that up. And so it's definitely getting a buzz, even before it's being released. The film has already gotten a buzz by being nominated for Best Picture, or actually winning Best Picture from the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, along with Gravity, the film that we discussed.
Sure, yeah. Greg, you've selected to talking about America cinema in black and white. That's a great title, and you take it in the order that you seem feels most comfortable. But there's a lot of good comparison in early movies, and then today, and then one that has gotten so much attention currently.
Yeah, well, we were inspired this time around by Rosa Parks, who boarded her bus on December 1st, 1955, and made history when she refused to give up her seat to a white male passenger about her age. And as was the law of that land, she was, as a black person, obliged to give up her seat and move to the back of the bus. By refusing to do so, she became a catalyst, which eventually launched the career of Reverend Martin Luther King and really threw the whole civil rights movement into the national limelight. So using that as a springboard, we decided to explore what was America watching that had some type of connection to what Rosa Parks had done. So what films, for example, had black actors or directed by black filmmakers? But the answer is very few. And that, of course, didn't change for decades. The most famous film, the most popular film, even today, when you adjust for box office, Gone with the Wind, was most Americans' viewpoint of the black character in cinema, right? So you know, blacks in Gone with the Wind were depicted as serfs who, while they, you know, had a hard life, they remained loyal to their lord master. Yeah, the blacks, in particular black slaves, are just sort of a backdrop. You know, they're just so much furniture, if you will, which is really a story about the white characters and how the Civil War affects them, and particularly the white Southern characters. So that was only like 5-10 years before, you know, in the mid-40s when America came in flocks to see Gone with the Wind. So in 1955, 10 years later, virtually nothing had changed much in cinema in terms of the depiction of blacks, except this very interesting film made by an Austrian expat director, Otto Preminger, who had already established a major Hollywood film career. And Preminger took a New York Broadway play called Carmen Jones, which in itself was inspired by the famous 19th century French opera by Georges Bizet, Carmen. And so he took the Broadway play, which had Americanized the French opera, and Americanized it by putting an all-black cast. And Broadway was much more liberal in its viewpoints of black relations than America as a whole, as you might think, because it was the center of intellectualism in America, and there was a liberal sort of intellectualism that was centered in New York, not to mention Black Harlem, where all the black intellectuals were, or most of the black intellectuals were centered. So here you have this very unusual play, although not that unusual for Broadway, an all-black cast. But here comes this now American film director, but born in Europe, who is determined to take the play and make it into a film. And the film is a contemporary film, so it's not a period piece. It's it takes place at the time of the movie is shown, so it's in the 40s and 50s. But it follows the storyline of the French opera, and it also includes the music. So this is a musical film called Carmen Jones. And what made it extraordinary, though, is it had an all-black cast, and that likely was the very first film distributed widely that had an all-black cast. Now, many of us probably know, many of our listeners probably know that there was a parallel film industry in America that produced films by black directors with black cast members, but exclusively for black audiences. But this film, Carmen Jones, even with all this sort of romanticized storyline and its classical underpinnings from French 19th century opera, it was pretty extraordinary. And it caused a big buzz. And no doubt, most people, if they hadn't seen the film, they at least had heard about this film with an all-black cast.
And I guess Otto Preminger had a reputation for taking on controversial topics, didn't he?
He did. And he was definitely... He did enough sort of mainstream films that gave him the resources, the financial resources, and the clout in Hollywood to go off on tangents and do films that he really wanted to do, like Carmen Jones. And so it likely took a European filmmaker rather than an American filmmaker to embrace this all-black cast film, and he actually self-financed the film.
Wow, and he had a great cast, too.
He did. I mean, two of the most beautiful actors ever to grace the screen, Dorothy Dandridge and her co-star, continue to be sort of icons of American. Harry Belafonte was her co-star.
Uh-huh.
Continue to be, paragons.
Oh, they are.
Cinematic, you know, male and female beauty are. That certainly made the film appealing in many ways. It did well in certain markets, but America just wasn't quite ready yet for a film with all black cast members.
Oh, interesting.
Now we're going to fast forward a few decades.
So that's maybe why a lot of people haven't heard of that, but it sounds like something to get a, if you're a film buff, to get a historical perspective, maybe pick that up on iTunes or on Amazon, somewhere like that.
Yeah, exactly. And as revolutionary or radical as the film was, in one sense, it was also rather benign, because it really didn't, even though it was supposed to be showing the contemporary black experience at that time, it really wasn't. These characters were really more characters from the 19th century, and they just happened to be African-American, and there wasn't a lot that spoke to the realistic African-American experience in that film, just because the underpinnings of the film were so classical.
I see. Sure. So, as you say, then we move forward to go ahead. I wasn't sure if you said move forward to now or before now.
Well, you know, so maybe 10 years after Carmen comes out, then we start having a realistic discussion in cinema about race relations in America. And leading the charge is the iconographic actor Sidney Poitier. And, you know, he actually spearheaded meaningful discussions of race relations in his films like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, 1967, and in He the Night, also 1967. But it took another 10 years before America was ready to actually embrace meaningful discussions of race relations.
And, of course, that hit many baby boomers just as they were coming of age.
Exactly. And depending on the age of the baby boomer, they may have been in college or high school or just beginning high school. But those two films certainly were influential, I think, in a lot of minds, in developing a lot of minds and mindsets about race relations.
Being aware and overly aware, that's true, yeah.
And the whole basis of interracial marriage that mm-hmm. was brought up in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. So now we fast forward another few decades to present day. And actually in 2013, there are a half a dozen films in Hollywood with leading black actors and several by black directors, including Lee Daniels, best known for Precious a couple of years ago. Lee Daniels' film called The Butler, which was about a butler in the White House, starring Forrest Whitaker and Oprah Winfrey. And then Malcolm Lee's romantic comedy Best Man Holiday, which has been a hit at the box office. But no doubt, the most controversial film by a black director with leading black actors this year and perhaps in decades is a film called 12 Years a Slave by British director Steve McQueen, who, by the way, is tons of attention. It's just a footnote. Steve McQueen, the British black director, is no relation to Steve McQueen, the American iconographic actor.
Was there some kind of a family influence there? Or?
Not at all. Okay. Coincidence.
All right.
So what makes 12 Years a Slave such an interesting film and why it's captured across the board the rave reviews of critics is that it digs beneath like many layers of myths that have been foisted by American popular culture about the black slave experience. And basically, what I'm saying here is that up until this point, we still have that kind of gone with the wind, especially in cinema, in large part, viewing the early black American experience in America, that slaves were, it was tough, but they were well taken care of, and most of them were very loyal to their masters, and everyone was kind and happy, and was one big happy family. But here comes British director Steve McQueen, and he sort of tears the scab off that wound that's never healed in America, the real conflict of slavery, and gives a really brutally realistic picture of what slavery probably was like. And I say probably it was like because the book, or rather the film, is based on an autobiography by a slave who had actually been a free black man with his family in New York, but through circumstances was kidnapped and taken to the South, where he was held for, as the name of the film implies, 12 years a slave.
Yeah, that movie, I think, is probably going to perhaps change attitudes, maybe even like the television program Roots or probably other examples, but it will likely do that.
Well, it's a good point you bring up, because Roots really, television was the first to really address in a realistic sense black-white relations and really the early roots of the black American experience. But even Roots was slightly romanticized, or if not romanticized, it didn't fully embrace sort of the realism of the experience, maybe because television, first of all, especially back then, as a mass media, just would not go to certain places in terms of brutality or violence or sexual violence, especially when Roots came out a couple of decades ago.
So, and it sounds like 12 Years a Slave did just that.
And 12 Years a Slave just did that, yeah. It had no compunction above addressing what for many slaves, most slaves, must have been their experience. You know, they essentially were treated like livestock, even though everyone knew they were people and they were the intelligent beings. They just happened to have a different color skin. So this film takes no prisoners. You know, it shows a series of villains, not just one villain, although we can go back to that point a little bit later, but it shows a series of villains of white slave owners who, in varying degrees, are evil. So you have, you know, one slave owner early in the film who certainly seems kind and nice, but at the end of the day refuses to hear the main character, and the main character is played also by a Brit, an African-American Brit, Chiwetel Ejiofor, who's been celebrated for many films, including Children of Men and the romantic comedy Love Actually. He refuses to acknowledge that the character played by Chiwetel Ejiofor is a free man, and he just, it's not convenient for him to do that, so he passes him on to another slave owner who's even worse than he is, or is truly sadistic. So this sort of eye-opening experience is like nothing we've ever seen.
Greg, I really like the way you juxtapose these two films, both of two entirely different eras, and then provided a review of both of them.
Well, and we've got some other good ideas coming up, too. So in our next round, we're going to explore the female warrior.
There's been a number of movies that have taken on that theme, haven't there?
Increasingly. And, of course, the one that's is a huge box office hit, and it's the sequel to the film that was really groundbreaking in depicting the female warrior, if you will. It's Catching the Fire, Hunger Games 2. And so we're going to explore that film and contrast it with the way, when we were younger, baby boomers' films depicted the female warrior. And in particular, we're going to look at the film Barbarella.
And that's certainly one film that made Jane Fonda's career in more ways than one. You know, I had forgotten how many extensive nude scenes she had in that film.
It certainly made Jane Fonda's career, or at least not made it, just launched it. So it made her an international star. But it's interesting how just a few decades separate these films.
Well, listen, Greg, thanks again so much. It's been really interesting, and we'll catch you next time.
Catch you next time, Eddie.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Thanks for listening to this BloomerBoomer.com podcast with movie reviewer and historian Greg Potasik. You can also catch Greg's film reviews for the international lifestyle and entertainment website, Monsters and Critics. We encourage you to leave a comment in the reply section of the podcast. Finally, we would love it if you'd register to receive our BloomerBoomer.com newsletter with more of Greg's movie reviews. Thanks again.